Coming up this week on The Right Side, did the Trudeau government do its research on the Paris deal and a carbon tax? A so-called strong, stable minority in BC, Rachel Notley appeals to conservatives, and the media hit job on Andrew Scheer. This is The Right Side, episode 19, recorded Saturday, June 3rd, 2017. The Scheer Smear. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of The Right Side. Shane and Patrick are here, as we are every other week.
Yeah, it's good to join you guys here in the first few days of June, and certainly a lot has happened over the last week, that's for sure.
Oh, it certainly has. It certainly has. Lots of interesting news about Canada, and I think you guys take the cake in BC, but we'll get there eventually. But of course, you might be wondering what The Right Side is. It is our show where we endeavor to cut through the bias and sensationalism that plagues the mainstream media in the news, something that you can see every day when you watch the news. And quite frankly, it's appalling that this can be called information delivery today when it's so infused with narrative and whatnot from one way or the other. So.
Yeah, and I think our last news segment, we will definitely be talking a lot about media sensationalism and bias.
Oh, I know you're going to be having fun with that one, aren't you?
it's going to be quite the eye opener for a lot of people that don't know much about the issue.
Yes. All right. So this week we're going to start off with our Canadian segment, and this relates, of course, to the announcement that was made by President Trump that he was leaving the Paris Climate Agreement. And through this, Trudeau says we'll always have Paris. So this Thursday, it was officially announced that the U.S. is pulling out of the Paris Climate Deal, regardless of whether or not you agree with the concept of the Paris Climate Deal. There are now huge repercussions for Canada for this, given that the U.S. is no longer going to be involved in it. Trudeau and his government have stated that there is no question they will continue to remain a part of the deal, which, of course, comprises the UK, EU, and many other countries throughout the world. China is even involved in it. What we do know is that Trudeau will impose a carbon tax. We also know that the US is not going to be having a carbon tax. And without the US contribution to the Paris Climate Deal, the expense required to be a part of this deal will increase for all involved. And yes, that means us here in Canada as well. What's more is this further puts us at a competitive disadvantage. Canadian businesses already need to deal with the high Canadian dollar, which decreases export profits. The fact that our carbon tax increases the cost of production, and now we'll be paying for the Paris Climate Deal when a business in the U.S. does not. So therefore, as you can see, competitive disadvantage for businesses and individuals in Canada because the U.S. is no longer involved in this. Aside from the EU, Canada is one of the largest developed nations to be a signee of the Paris Climate Agreement, and we'll feel the cost of this regardless of what our government says or not. China and India don't need to implement the deal until into the 2030s when they're one of the largest polluters. We also know that Russia, even though showing some positive encouragement towards a deal, won't implement it because Russia is Russia at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And any other developing nations will be the ones to receive benefits from the climate deal rather than having to pay into it. So while the mainstream media has been focused primarily on the U.S. withdrawing from the deal and how this isolates President Trump and puts him alone on the world stage, the Canadian media is missing the huge story here of these economic side effects that are going to come to Canadian individuals and businesses as a result of this and the Paris Climate Agreement on the whole. One would hope that, you know, our government realizes the cost and does the appropriate research. And you think that this would probably be a thing that the Trudeau government would do with no questions asked, because that was one of the things that they campaigned on, evidence-based policy, using evidence, using science studies where applicable. I think that was part of the whole Real Change platform.
And generally, every government wants to conduct studies about different policy issues and what they would, what impact they would have before they're implemented, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the question was, has the Trudeau government done this? No, they have not. They haven't done it in relation to the carbon tax, and they haven't done it in relation to the Paris climate deal. An access information request was submitted by the Rebel, and it asked the following. Please provide copies of any studies or analysis done on the potential impact of proceeding with action on climate change and carbon pricing alone without cooperative or comparable actions by the United States on Canadian industry, the Canadian economy, and individual Canadians since January 1st, 2016. The response from the government on this was, no records were found concerning this request. So, to sum it up, we know that the government will impose a carbon tax. We know that the GST will be charged on the carbon tax. We know that the U.S. will not be having a carbon tax. We know that the U.S. will be leaving the Paris climate deal. And this ultimately means that the writing is on the wall, that the impact on the Canadian economy will be massive just based on the three previous bullet points alone. But then when the U.S. government pulls out of the Paris climate deal, that just inflames the issue further. The Canadian government even went as far to suggest that our environment minister, Catherine McKenna, knew better than the U.S. administration in terms of what businesses and individuals would want in the U.S. And I would like to ask the question now, would we like it if the Americans told us what was best for our affairs?
Probably not. And the fact that no records were found concerning that request about how the lack of U.S. in the Paris deal would affect Canada, it either means that they either did no research on it, or they did and they didn't like the answers, so they decided to cover it up, which, you know, governments cover up things all the time, right?
Right, and if they're doing that for an access to information request, that's really slimy.
Yeah, and either way, it's a bad thing, right? If they didn't do any research, that's not good. And if they did do the research, found that they didn't like the answers, and then decided to cover it up and go ahead with it anyways, that's almost even worse, I think.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's all lining up to look like the Canadian carbon tax is just a pure ideological move to make those in the Liberal government, Liberal supporters, and those in Trudeau's globalist movement to look good and feel good for the day on the world stage when, in reality, our number one trading partner is the U.S. That's the economy we're closely linked to, and we should be following their lead in terms of their economy in order to maintain a competitive edge on the world stage. So, and I'd just like to end this segment by saying that at the end of the day, it's money and productivity that's what matters in an economy. And if the Liberal government has done no analysis on this impact to Canada, well, that means they don't care about the economy. And without a strong economy, the middle class suffers and the population suffers as a whole. So the Liberal government, if indeed they don't care and if indeed they haven't actually done these studies, they're setting the economy up for some massive pain going forward.
And it's funny because I've actually been watching a bit of Question Period lately, and a lot of the answers to a bunch of questions from the Liberals is how things will benefit the middle class. And it's something that they campaigned on about helping the middle class, lowering taxes for the middle class, helping the middle class find jobs and affordable housing, and basically decreasing the burden on the middle class. And this is something that would impact the middle class quite a bit as the economy. And the fact that they're not either not doing the research or not liking the research done, it's going to have massive impacts on it.
Yeah, and you know, this is one thing that the previous conservative government was always really held up for and commended on the world stage for was a strong middle class, you know, best in the G7, highest medium incomes based on the OECD averages. And, you know, it really shows the difference between these two governments about where the priorities lie. One, of course, focusing on the individual residents and the population, the middle class. The others looking towards globalist movements.
Well, with that, a bit of bit of news, I think we'll head over to BC now, where, of course, as we knew after last week's episode, there was a bit of uncertainty in BC, and I mentioned how anything can happen at any time, and that's generally the case in politics, and why you should always be staying tuned to the current events in the news, and keeping up with us here on the right side is always a good way to do that, because we will always give it to you straight, and we will always let you know what's happening. So before Tuesday, and I say Tuesday because there was something that happened on Tuesday, there were a bunch of bad, really bad, what I would call opinion articles. There was one that was trying to determine who would be in the cabinet of, quote, Premier Horgan before, he's even put into that position.
Or even before the confidence vote to remove Christy Clark happens.
Yeah. And there was also one article even suggesting that the Liberals and NDP should work together to come across things. And we know for a fact, just by listening to them in the debates, just by seeing what's going on, the fact that the Liberals have been in power for 16 years against the NDP, we knew this would not work whatsoever. So the fact that that article came out was something crazy. And I was gonna run with these stories and the fact that how the media is just trying to throw out all these random opinions doesn't make sense whatsoever. But on Tuesday afternoon, everything changed with the news that the BC Green leader, Andrew Weaver, and the BC NDP leader, John Horgan, had formed an agreement to topple Premier Christy Clark at the earliest opportunity, and this deal would allow an NDP minority government to survive a four-year term, and the combined alliance would lead to a governing arrangement with the margin of only one single seat over the incumbent Liberals. And the balance of power is that much more precarious when you consider that any new government has to appoint a Speaker of the House. So in their joint press conference announcing the agreement, which I watched, and I think you watched as well, Shane.
That's right.
We noticed that Andrew Weaver described the arrangement as a framework to give British Columbians a, quote, strong, stable minority government, end quote. But even though there's just one-seat majority of 44 out of 87 seats, just one MLA missing a vote with, say, as the province described, a sudden onset of diarrhea, could topple the government in a single key vote. And it's been noted that many projects, such as the Trans Mountain Pipeline, the Kinder Morgan Pipeline, the Massey Tunnel Replacement Bridge Project, and the Site C Dam, would all be in jeopardy with an NDP government supported by the Greens, as both of these parties oppose all of these projects and many other energy projects that would be good for the economy. And it's also been noted that a switch in the government could have far-reaching consequences on the economy, not just for BC, but for Canada as a whole.
That's what they think. But, I mean, when it comes to, at the end of the day, natural resources are a federal jurisdiction, and the province can hold it up in court. But it'll be interesting to see how much sway they end up having over this.
If anything happens, I mean, it's all still in the early days, but
you're right. This entire thing could change by next week.
Exactly. And it's also noted that a couple episodes ago, in episode 17 of The Right Side, that the Greens would push heavily for electoral reform without a referendum. But with this agreement that I read through, the NDP seems to not really want to change the electoral system without a referendum, which is something that I will actually commend them for, because changing electoral system without a referendum is not something that anyone would want.
It's the cornerstone of democracy. If you don't ask the people about it, that is a very undemocratic action.
Yeah. So Clark still remains the premier for now until she loses a confidence vote in the legislature, which would likely be the throne speech if she attempts to form government. If Clark then tries to stay on as opposition leader, which she said she would do, she could actually face troubles in her own party with a lot of the other factions of the party being dissatisfied with her leadership. The fact that she went into the 2013 election, won a majority, but still lost her own seat. And now into the 2017 election, where they won the most seats but may not be able to form governments, that could be, you know, it could be cause problems for her and her own party. But that's just some speculation. We don't really know exactly what's going to happen. But she did say in a press conference that she wouldn't resign until her government falls in the legislature. She said, quote, "If there's going to be a transfer of power in this province, and it certainly seems like there will be, it shouldn't be done behind closed doors. It should happen in public, and it should happen in the People's House with 87 members elected by British Columbians to our legislature making that decision," end quote. So with that in mind, now we just have to wait until the legislature reconvenes to see what the next move will be. One thing's for sure, this roller coaster ride is not over yet.
Yeah, and I mean, after being premier for so long and having this government in power, there are people out there who are going to want change. But I can't see that this would be the last effort for her. Because you win the most votes, you win the most seats, surely you would have some kind of effort out there to make an attempt to form government. Maybe something in the throne speech, perhaps, that could change all of this and entice some NDP or maybe even the Greens to support?
Yeah, well, with a razor-thin a majority of 44 over 43.
That's
all it
not
takes
stable.
For one, that's not stable whatsoever, despite what Andrew Weaver says. One person could cross the floor and it would change things by quite a bit. One person could miss a vote and that would end up being tied. A lot of things could happen here. And the fact that the Greens went with the NDP and then tried to say that it was a strong, stable minority government. Because you have to remember that the Greens, they have their own horse in the race here too, and that they want minorities to be perceived as working, because if they are in a minority situation, they hold the balance of power. So they want it.
And that's likely also
a coalition.
Also what would happen under proportional representation is that it would be a constant minority government.
Yeah, so they want to show that this is going to work. But with 44 out of 87... it's probably not going to work.
And that brings up the next very point here, is that if the government falls and Christy Clark is not successful and they bring this deal to the lieutenant governor, there's no guarantee that the lieutenant governor will okay this for these exact reasons. One MP disappears and this government that was deemed to be stable falls apart.
Yeah, so who knows? I mean, the lieutenant governor could say, "Oh yeah, sure, give it a try," and then one confidence vote fails, and we're going right back to an election. And then who knows what would happen then? It all depends on who is able to get out their narrative best, the media, and who is going to be perceived as pushing for the election first. And like I said, we don't know. Even with this in place, we still don't know what's going to happen. And
yeah,
there's going to be a lot of questions raised after this, I think.
Someone could pull a Kathleen Wynne from Ontario, because this is a very similar situation she had prior to her majority government that she got a couple of years ago. So,
yeah.
Who knows? All right. Well, let's move on to Alberta now. And a very strangely worded piece from Global News entitled "Rachel Notley Makes Appeal to Conservatives Turned Off by Potential Merger of Wild Rose and PCs." Premier Rachel Notley says that the NDP would welcome anyone who feels like they wouldn't have a political home in the United Conservative Party. The United Conservative Party is the party that will be created if this summer the Wild Rose and PCs ratify the unity agreement that we talked about a couple weeks ago. Rachel Notley then proceeded to say that both Jason Kenney and Brian Jean are getting more extreme in their views. "And to those Albertans who feel like they don't have a political home, I ask you to take another look at our government, our party, and our record." So,
I'm sorry, we're trying to be unbiased and not sensationalist here, but you just kind of have to laugh at that. The fact that she's using the words extreme in there is, you know, she's trying to make the comparison that they're to the far right and that she's in the center, more moderate, more rational, and that sort of thing. And It's funny how she says, I ask you to take another look at our government, our party, and our record, because if you look at their record, it's not something that you really want to be proud of, is it?
Credit rating downgrades, massive deficits, massive debt, job layoffs, very draconian union legislation that's just passed, the farming Bill 6 fiasco, tons of things like that. But ultimately, what's not stated in the article is that by the next next election, which will happen in 2019, it's likely to become a referendum on the NDP's record, because that's what happens in elections like this, where a majority government comes in and changes things. And ultimately, it's very likely that this referendum will shape up as other parties versus the NDP. And anyone who is potentially considering the United Conservative Party as an option is unlikely to vote for the NDP, because the NDP, first and foremost, doesn't stand for free enterprise and removing economic red tape. The United Conservative Party does, or rather will. And if the media was wanting to make this comparison, or if Rachel Notley was wanting to make this comparison, it would be a far better comparison to have another party, such as the Alberta Party, for example, and make the statement that they are the welcoming to anyone who does not feel welcome in the United Conservative Party. So ultimately, this kind of announcement should have come from the Alberta Party, or maybe even the Alberta Liberals on this, compared to the NDP. And it kind of shows what the NDP is thinking for their 2019 platform as being the moderate center choice. But we'll just have to wait and see on that. The story also goes to show what the media dynamics will be like in 2019. As we've seen with Andrew Scheer federally, it's already shaping up that the new leader of the United Conservative Party will face a similar coordinated attack by the media on any number of issues that have been put to bed in the past or are expressly prohibited by the United Conservative Party charter. Some of these could be along the lines of equality for all, publicly funded and accessible health care, and public education. And ultimately, at this time, it appears as though Global intended this to be a wedge story to preemptively frame the narrative as either UCP or NDP, when that's entirely presumptuous, as we don't even know if the United Conservative Party will be created at this stage. So ultimately, we need to look for this kind of story framing as we get closer to the 2019 election.
Yeah, and it's funny how they're trying to present themselves as more moderate when they are a traditional NDP government. This is something that NDP governments have done in the past in Ontario, in Manitoba, in BC, Nova Scotia. And what's interesting is that sooner or later...
I wouldn't even call it a prairie NDP government.
Well, sooner or later, all of these NDP governments get voted out. And there's a good reason as to why they get voted out and why they're rarely seen from again. And the fact that she's trying to get a lot of the probably more moderate conservatives to vote for the NDP, it almost seems like a last-ditch effort to try and boost her support, you know?
You know, we haven't seen any polls, but once again, disclaimer, polls not to be trusted. But maybe she's seeing something internally that she doesn't like.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. The ball's in her court. I still don't preclude her doing something next spring, or maybe even this fall, if the United Conservative Party is still getting going. Because, I mean, it could be treacherous like that. But We'll just have to wait and see. All right, so as we get closer to 2019 here and in Alberta, I know that over the last week you've been looking specifically at media framing, and you're ready to have some fun with this story that's next.
Yeah, and it's been something that we've been talking about a lot since the last episode, something that we've both been looking at. And that is, of course, the media reaction to the election of Andrew Scheer to the Conservative Party leadership. And now he is the official opposition leader. And a lot of the media outlets, when they see someone new on the political scene that they don't really know that much about, they will either try and make assumptions about him, or they'll try and make up a lot of information about him. And that's something that we've certainly seen a lot in the last little while. So with that, we'll start off with an article that was just posted a day after the election, And that was that Andrew Scheer was linked to what they refer to as linked to the controversial media outlet, the Rebel.media. And that
didn't
is,
we just quote a perfectly fine journalistic piece from the Rebel about government research?
Yeah, we certainly did. And what's interesting is that the article in Global News, it frames Andrew Scheer as having a huge huge link with this, in that he's made himself available to do interviews with them in the past, and since he's been elected the leader, he still made himself available. And it's trying to frame this as a bad thing, and the fact that this is what they led with right after the leadership election is, it's something that should be, you know, could be described as deplorable, because they're not really doing their due diligence to the public in explaining who Andrew Scheer is, what he stands for, but instead they're trying to link him to a media outlet simply for doing interviews for them. And of course, you know, politicians do lots of interviews with lots of different media outlets. Would you say that they have links to all of them? I don't think so. It has noticed that they did notice that the Scheer's campaign did have what they call a direct connection to the Rebel, which was that Scheer's campaign manager, Hamish Marshall, was listed as a director on the company's federal incorporation records. But he describes himself as not being involved at all in the content production or the editorials. He's simply with the business side of things. So the fact that that's the link that they're talking about, and how that's linking him to all of the controversial stuff that the Rebel has been involved in the past, it's really disingenuous to a lot of people that probably are looking to the news to find out more about Andrew Scheer, what he stands for, what his policies are, and to figure out if they should vote for him or not. So that was just the first of many, many of the articles that that talked about Andrew Scheer. Now, you may be wondering, okay, well, that's just one example. I mean, you can't portray the media as one giant organization. And that's fairly true. A lot of people look to, for instance, the National Post as an organization that's kind of outside of the gigantic media conglomerate, because they often put out articles about many different viewpoints, contrary to what the other media outlets will put out. So in this one, there is a, in this certain article that I'm referencing here, there was a article that showed Andrew Scheer's leap from a 25-year-old newly elected MP in 2004, all the way up to when he was elected Speaker of the House of Commons in 2011, and up to now in 2017, where he is elected leader of the Conservative Party, and the, you know, the transition and the steps that he's made to get this far in his political career. And it's actually a fairly well-written article, I think. But the problem is that it has a really terrible title as the article title. And it's called, quote, "How a 4-year-old abortion ruling began Andrew Scheer's remarkable leap from speaker to leader." Now,
oh my gosh.
And
I mean, I'm just picturing the words in my head, and
it sounds terrible.
It sounds like it's a ruling on abortion relating to 4-year-olds.
Yeah, it sounds like he's wanting to abort 4-year-olds. it just made me scratch my head. It's like, why would they come up with that certain title? Like, whoever came up with that title should be fired, because that's not even how the article goes. But you look at that article title, do you actually want to click on it? Like, you're probably thinking, what on earth is he doing? And then you look at it, it doesn't talk about that whatsoever. It talks about, his rise to where he is now. But they could have come up with a much better title for that. You know, I was expecting
BuzzFeed level of editorial right there.
Yeah, I was expecting more from the National Post when I came to that. And And it's funny because in another National Post article, Calgary MP Michelle Rempel, who we know quite well on the media, she, you know, guest hosts on the CBC quite often as one of their political analysts, and, you know, she's fairly generally outspoken in her views as well. She was quoted as being frustrated that the only question asked of her by the media about Scheer is about the social conservatives. And she correctly notes that the party's mostly generally focused on the economy, and that Scheer has repeatedly said that he wouldn't reopen debate on same-sex marriage or abortion, despite what his own personal beliefs are on the matter, which kind of echoes Stephen Harper's earlier decisions to do the same, if we remember back to when he was prime minister. But, however, the issue of the media talking about the social conservatives and how Scheer will be making policy on social conservative values is unproven, unfounded, and unfair. I mean, many articles from the Globe and Mail, CBC, and many others have also focused heavily on the social conservatives and how much of a role social conservatives would have in influencing Scheer and his policies if he was ever elected. And also in the National Post, political commentator Andrew Coyne ran with a headline, quote, "In the dullness of the morning after, Andrew Scheer is the safer pair of hands," in which he described Scheer as, quote, "soporific," which, of course, to anyone who doesn't know, means being able to put someone to sleep. And, of course, how Scheer would have to listen to the social conservatives who voted for him, which, you know, this conveniently ignores, you know, all the centrists, such as myself, all of the Western Canadians, all of the Quebecers, and the Maritime Canadians who voted for them. Well, I mean, it's another example of the mainstream media trying to paint Scheer as a candidate who only won due to social conservatives.
Key point, Andrew Scheer ran the riding of Beauce, where Maxime Bernier was from.
Yeah, and he won a lot of ridings in Atlantic Canada. He won ridings in BC. He completely won the province of Saskatchewan. And he won in a lot of ridings where a lot of people wouldn't expect him to win. And so it's not just because of social conservatives that the reason why Scheer won. It's a lot of different reasons and a lot of different people with a lot of different beliefs that voted for him. So there was another article on the National Post that was written by John Iveson, who described Scheer as, quote, cautious to the point of catatonia. And he also wrote an article saying why Scheer wouldn't win in 2019, but that he would win in 2023 if he was able to gain momentum. But in the article, he kind of forgets that we're a long way from 2019 to begin with, let alone 2023. And once again, anything can happen at any time in politics, right? And another National Post columnist, Kelly McParland, also wrote an article with the question, quote, "Andrew who?" at the forefront, and goes on to describe how liberal outlets like the Toronto Star are trying to paint Scheer as a unknown nobody and should therefore be dismissed rather than researched. I mean, fair enough, that's actually happening. A lot of the liberal outlets are trying to dismiss Andrew Scheer as someone who is a threat to the established political discourse because they don't really know anything about him. But this would be better served if the article then actually describes Scheer and his policies rather than just explain what the liberals are saying about him. I mean, it's practically giving them freak press.
Two things on this. As former speaker, he is far from an unknown in Ottawa, the House of Commons. That's point number one. And point number two, Andrew Scheer is not one that is going to be out there to disrupt the status quo in Canada. He is no Donald Trump.
No. I mean, he's been working in Ottawa. He was first elected in 2004. He's built up a network of people that he knows in Ottawa. He's been speaker, which means he's had to mediate a lot of different issues. And he's also been He's been there for a while, and he has a lot of support within his own party. So, if anything, he's more of an establishment-type person than he would be a revolutionary. But the fact that they're just painting him as someone who's unknown and then just dismissing him because of that, it's actually quite bad. And the fact that they put out this article and then didn't actually describe Sheerness policies rather than explain what the liberals are saying about him. It's basically giving the liberal MPs that are saying these things free press, and it's just letting their views get to more people. But that's just the National Post. It actually gets worse from the other outlets. Yeah, there's actually more, because we've just talked about one thing from the Global News and most from the National Post, but also in the Globe and Mail, another article similar to the other one, it quoted liberal MPs as saying Scheer would, quote, reopen debate on done issues and has, quote, voted against every social advancement of the last 25 years and described the race as a battle between, quote, far-right social conservatives and far-right economic conservatives. So there's quite a few issues with all of those. But I think the
voted
most
voted against every social advancement of the past 25 years.
Yeah, the fact that they say he's voted against every social advancement, that's quite something, considering, as I said, he's only been in, Ottawa since, in the past 13 years. He's a pretty young guy at 38, so the fact that he has been able to vote for these things at age 13, that's quite something. And not only that, but I think we should take issue with the fact that the race was between, quote, far-right social conservatives and far-right economic conservatives, because far-right is something that the left tries to demonize conservatives as quite often. You see this in the U.S. quite a bit. But far-right actually describes fascism and Nazism, which are both things that the Conservative Party is not whatsoever. And really, they should be denounced for making these comparisons. But yet the article actually treats their opinions fairly and notes that we'll probably be seeing more of this. That's pretty surprising. I mean, the fact that we're going to see more people describe not only just social conservatives, but any conservative in general as being far right, that's something that we really don't want to see more of. And I think it's kind of went on with another article in the Globe and Mail. We saw something else that quoted Scheer and described him as, quote, no one's idea of a charismatic political savior. And it kind of went on to say that the diverse opinions within the Conservative Party would fracture the party from the inside. And it suggests that the party has a unity issue and that Scheer won't be able to fix these so-called issues. I mean, it's true that he only won with 51% of the vote on the final ballot, but that in no way suggests that the party is divided. I mean, you look at the debates and you look at the convention itself, and most of them are quite amicable. And on the whole, it was actually quite friendly. And, all of the competitors that are MPs, they're really likely to work closely together in the House of Commons. And I think one just has to listen to Andrew Scheer to know that he isn't uncharismatic. He's actually quite personable, witty, and charming. He's got quite a sense of humor. I mean, this just flies in the face of the media, who's trying to paint him as a Harper-esque social conservative robot with no social skills or personality, but it's really not the case whatsoever. And I think the fact that they had such a hit job on Stephen Harper when he was prime minister for his perceived lack of social skills and personality, and the fact that they're just trying to do the same thing to Scheer, that's something that should be raising alarm bells in a lot of people that look at what's going on in the media.
It shows that there is no argument that the media is willing to go out and research, and there is no actual story there. And instead, they're actually, in essence, making things up based on the information they have rather than actual issues and doing journalism on those issues. And that's going to continue. And I think that is likely what can be called fake news.
Yeah. And speaking of fake news, let's head over to another outlet known as the CBC. They kind of took a different approach entirely. They ran with an article comparing Andrew Scheer to Joe Clark, who we all remember for not being able to form government for very long. And the fact that they compared him to him was just based on the comparison that Scheer's going to be running against Trudeau, just like Joe Clark ran against Trudeau Sr. They didn't really make any other comparisons based on that, but they're trying to compare Scheer to Joe Clark, just based on the fact that he's running against a Trudeau, when in fact they're probably two very different people with very different opinions. And we'll go now to another CBC article where
I just want to take a moment here and tell the listeners to brace for impact on this one.
Yeah. So there was another one, which is actually an interview with a 12-year-old self-confessed political junkie who actually makes quite a few good points about Andrew Scheer, but he's largely dismissed because they are, of course, the opinions of a 12-year-old. And he's trying to, in the article, it's made out to be that the people who believe this, who would actually agree with this 12-year-old, should be dismissed just because it's coming from someone who's so young. But also, there's another article that CBC writer Neil MacDonald said that he doesn't believe Andrew Scheer when he says that he won't explore certain topics because, you know, in the past he said he wouldn't reopen the abortion debate. He wouldn't, you know, try and repeal same-sex marriage. He wouldn't go after a lot of these different social conservative beliefs. But he says that he doesn't believe Scheer when he says that he won't do that, and he believes that Scheer's religious beliefs will define his policies. Newsflash, if you discount someone else's beliefs because you believe without evidence that they're false, that's not being smart, that's just being a hypocrite.
And this is, of course, reported as news.
Yeah, it's not reported as an opinion piece. This is what they call news. But I think perhaps, you know, out of all of this, you'd think, well, this is pretty bad. But believe it or not, it actually gets worse. I think the worst hit job of them all actually belongs to the Huffington Post, Warren Kinsella. Let me just read an excerpt from the beginning of his article. Smirk, the economy, Justin Trudeau, free speech, his deceased mother, ISIS. On every subject, no matter how sad or serious, Andrew Scheer would smirk. It was, well, weird. His rictus was so off-putting, we started to forget what he was actually saying. I know here at the Right Side, like I said before, we try to be unbiased and not sensationalist, but honestly, what follows after that excerpt is probably the biggest pile of garbage article I've ever had the displeasure to read in my life, and it actually attempts to portray Scheer as, quote, the smirking new face of social conservatism, and how the author feels that everything about Scheer is terrible, wrong, and morally backwards. And if you really feel like I'm exaggerating that the media is trying to discredit Scheer, just simply reading that article will actually probably convert people to that belief. With all of this, is it any wonder that Faith Goldie, of the before mentioned The Rebel, predicted just moments after Scheer's win at the convention center that the, quote, biggest threat facing Scheer isn't Trudeau's liberals, it's the mainstream media. And what's worse is that she's actually right.
My point, and what I believe on this entire matter, is that if these were all legitimate news pieces, they could have been reported before Andrew Scheer won the election. After all, this race has tentatively been going on since fall 2015. And as a result of that, there was all of 2016 and these first few months of 2017 to write any of these articles, promote them on nightly newscasts and online about Andrew Scheer or any of the other 13 candidates that were running in this race. And the very fact that these articles didn't start coming out until after he won proves exactly what you're saying here, is that it is a coordinated hit job on Andrew Scheer.
Yeah, and what I could see from is that I wanted to get my own evidence based on Andrew Scheer and what he was going to do to try and hold the Trudeau government to account and what he would do differently to their government. And so I've been looking at a lot of interviews that he's done, and I've been looking at question period over the past week and what he's been trying to do to hold the government to account for the policies that they've done. And what I see is a very confident leader, a very good speaker in both English and French, a very a very smart person, and not only that, but someone who has a bit of humor to him. He's able to use all of these tools to try and hold the government to account. And the fact that he's doing all this, it shows that he's a very poised leader and that he is very capable of defeating Trudeau. And that probably worries the media, who, of course, doesn't like change like this. And they are clearly uniting on this issue to try and damage his reputation and to try and discredit him and stop him from you know, doing well or winning against Trudeau. And I think with that, that brings us to the word of the week, which you have for us.
Yeah, it's a very fitting word of the week for this last segment. And the word of the week is smear, as defined by the New Oxford American Dictionary. To damage the reputation of someone by false accusations, slander, someone who was trying to smear her name by faking letters. And of course, in terms of this story, rather than faking letters, it's faking news.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of people on many different sides of the political spectrum will look at what's happening in the U.S. and how Trump came to power and how he, you know, quoted how he could be quoted by saying fake news quite a bit, and how the mainstream media is out to get him. And a lot of people would probably look at that with a lot of skepticism, and they may be right. But when you look at certain issues like this, you can see for sure that they have an agenda and that they have a way of writing pieces to make it seem like they're news when they're actually not. And I think that's just something that we all have to remember, is that no matter where you're getting your information from, you have to think about it critically.
Yep.
And to not take it as gospel, and to, you know, find out this information for yourself about what's happening, what a certain issue is, or, you know, even who a person is, or who a political leader is and what their policies are. Because if you're listening to just one source on this, you're not going to get the full information, and you're probably not going to get the right information. And when you're wanting to get the correct information, that's something you can always do at The Right Side.
Yes.
Which you can find us at rightsidenews.ca. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at rightsideca, as well as on iTunes at rightsidenews.ca/iTunes.
And I would encourage everyone listening to this, if you're interested in this and you want to see that we're not just making this up, normally we don't include all of the supplemental URLs that we use for producing these stories, but I think we will this week because there were just so many of them, and it's really an interesting read. So that'll be in the show notes. And, you know, as you were saying, I encourage everyone to do their own reading on this. We make our sources that we use for all these stories out there. We're not bending the truth. This is what's there. These are things that are reported, some stories that should be reported but are not. We bring those out to the forefront, and all the sources are at rightsidenews.ca. So with that being said, head there, read the show notes, read all of the hit pieces on Andrew Scheer if you so desire to see that the media is actually doing this. And until then, hopefully you guys will have finished reading by the time next week's episode airs. But until then, thank you for sharing your time with us, and we'll see you next week.
And we will be here in a week with more news and more discussion about all the happenings that are going on in Canada. So we will see you then.